Okay, I'm going to start with a word of prayer. Lord, I thank you for your goodness, because you're so good. I ask you to speak to me. I ask you to give me ears to hear what you would say, and I feel like you did, and I thank you for that. All that you spoke to me may just be for me, and if that's the case, that's okay, and I'm sorry for all of you, but hopefully you can draw something from it too. I trust God that he knows what he's doing. And I just thank him and give him this service. In Jesus' name, amen. So, I'm going to start this morning with a story that I heard the other day, and I'm going to pass it on to you. I'm going to talk to you today about some stuff that is all things that I've heard in the last week or more, things that I have read. So I'm not taking credit for any of these things, pretty much. I'm just passing them on, okay? Somebody smarter than me and whatever has said some of these things, and the way God works, sometimes he can say this most profound thing through the dumbest person. It's just the way it is. Hopefully that'll be the case this morning. So here I am. So anyway, I want to share this story with you. Now, whether the story is exactly true or not, I don't know, but it's just a story, okay? And it's a story of King Louis XI of France. And King Louis XI of France had an astrologer in his court, you know, his inner circle of people, his advisors, and I'm sure the court jester was one of those and stuff like that. So he had an astrologer in his court, and the astrologer predicted that one of the ladies of the court would die within so many days. And the lady died within so many days. So Louis got nervous, and he thought to himself, either this astrologer murdered this lady to prove that he can predict the future, or he actually can predict the future, he thought. And then he thought, well, what if he can predict the end of King Louis? And that kind of scared him. So the king decided that the astrologer had to die. And he tells his servants, he says, next time he comes in, when I give the signal, I want you to grab him and throw him out the window. And I'm sure they were pretty high up because he said it would be certain death. So, of course, his servants have to obey what he says. So the astrologer comes in to see King Louis. And the king asks him one last question. He says, given your ability to predict the future, tell me how long will you live? And without hesitation, the astrologer said, I will die 3 days before your majesty. And King Louis never gave the signal to throw him out the window because he wasn't sure whether he knew or not. Now, the ability to predict what is to come can provide very useful knowledge, okay? But more often, it's used more to gain power and profit. And I'm not a big conspiracy theory guy, but if you think about all the data that is collected about every one of us, with everything that we watch and see and read about and look at, someone is paying a lot of money to learn about you. And why is that? So that they can predict who you are, what you think, and what you want out of life, and how you'll spend your money, if we're honest. You know, it's not a coincidence when you search for some kind of an item and then it shows up at the bottom of your screen in an ad. The first time I remember that, Holden was playing baseball and I was looking at a baseball bat for him. And I'm looking at baseball bats and I get done and I go to do something else, and at the bottom of the screen there's an ad for that baseball bat flashing in my corner, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. That's not coincidence. It's meant to be that way. Now, I thank God that he did not give me, and I'm not throwing rocks at anybody, he did not give me the desire to be a gambler. I'm not a gambler. I don't enjoy it. It doesn't do anything for me. I like to play cards, and I would even play poker if I understood it more, but I don't care about trying to win money or that kind of thing. I just don't. It doesn't thrill me. You know, a month or so ago, I talked to you a little bit about Pete Rose, remember? Pete had a gambling problem. I don't want a gambling problem. So, sports betting right now in our world has gone crazy. It's insane. In 2017, I read that $5 billion were wagered on sporting events, mostly at casinos and places like that. In 2024, $150 billion was bet on sports. And most of that was done online. And what are you doing when you bet on a sports event? You're predicting what's going to happen, right? I don't know if any of you care about the NBA. The championship just got over last night. The Knicks beat the Spurs. The other night, the Spurs were up 29 points at what point of the third quarter, Holden? 7 minutes ago in the third quarter, the Spurs were up by 29 points. Guess who lost? The Spurs lost. I doubt there were many people predicted that they were going to come back from 29 points down and win that game, but that's what happened. There's things called prediction markets that allow people to wager on everything from global elections to oil prices to, and this is no joke because I looked at one the other day, this was a question on there that you could bet yes or no on. Will the U.S. confirm that aliens exist by December the 31st, yes or no, or September the 30th, yes or no? And it looked like there were $53 million wagered on it at that point in time. So it's kind of crazy what's going on in that way right now. So we are living in a day of predictions, more now than ever before, I believe. And this plays into our desire to predict what will happen in the future, and it's because of our fears of not knowing what is to come. And now they've added in a chance to make money, and they've turned life into a sport to a point, kind of, in some ways. So, you know, with all the information that's available to us nowadays, because there is a lot of information that's available to us, the idea that with enough information you can predict the future, AI, anyone? Isn't that kind of what it's trying to do? If you're looking, I heard someone say this the other day. Here's the flaw of that idea. If you have enough information, you can predict what's going to happen. If you're looking for a needle in a haystack, adding more hay doesn't make it easier to find the needle. So that's the things that God talked to me about this week, a little bit about predictions, okay? And why am I talking to you about that? And this is Mark being honest to you. You know, I feel like I've spent the last year trying to predict or know what was next for us. And that has been exhausting and overwhelming, and I'm just being honest, okay? Now, because I don't have all the answers, in spite of weighing so many things to think about in it, I don't have all the answers. So the other day I heard this question that really made me think, and it was just what I needed to hear. It said, where do you go when you get to the threshold of what you know? Do you go back to what you've known and where you've been before? Or do you go forward into the unknown and see where you end up? Now, this question is important to all of us because in life, our relationships, our health, the state of the world, change never stops. And we can't predict what's next. So the question you have to ask yourself, when you reach that threshold, will you advance or will you stop? So I'm going to read you something you've heard a million times, but I'm going to read it anyway. Philippians 4, 6 to 9 says, don't worry about anything. Instead, pray about everything. Tell God your needs and don't forget to thank him for his answers. If you do this, you will experience God's peace, which is far more wonderful than the human mind can understand. His peace will keep your thoughts and your hearts quiet and at rest as you trust in Christ Jesus. And now, brothers, as I close this letter, let me say this one more thing. Fix your thoughts on what is true and good and right. Think about things that are pure and lovely, and dwell on the fine good things in others. Think about all you can praise God for and be glad about. Keep putting into practice all you learned from me and saw me doing, and the God of peace will be with you. So that was the beginning of what I need to talk to you about today. Now we're going to change course a little bit, what we're really not, because we'll get back to that a little bit. Well, before I go on, I heard someone the other day also say something that really got to me, and it said, don't try so hard to be something. Just be exactly what you are. So I've been reading this book. In 2017, Joey and I had our 25th wedding anniversary, and we took a trip, and we went to Niagara Falls, which was a nice trip. Niagara Falls is beautiful. It's amazing. It's impressive. And then being that we're both baseball fans, we went to the Baseball Hall of Fame after that. From Niagara Falls, we went to Cooperstown. And I loved seeing the artifacts at the Baseball Hall of Fame. I've loved baseball since I was a little kid. I'm not a little kid anymore, but I still love the game. Me and Joe love to watch baseball together. It doesn't consume me like it did when I was a kid, and that's fine. It shouldn't. But I'll tell you, of the beautiful, awesome Niagara Falls that we saw and all the cool stuff at the Baseball Hall of Fame that we saw, my favorite part of the trip was riding in the car, talking and laughing, and looking at the beautiful New York countryside in northern New York and all the leaves that were turned. And listening to, it's funny because I wrote these notes Friday night and Saturday morning, and then Joey mentioned this exact thing to me yesterday. Listening to Diana Krall sing Standards on this CD that we had as we were driving up there. And we also listened to a book on CD. And the book's called Tuesdays with Maury. And we were enjoying that, and then the last CD was either missing or broken or something, and we couldn't finish the book. So that was where it ended for us. I don't know, some of you may have heard it, some of you may have read it, I don't know. Well, I bought it at Goodwill the other day for like a dollar. because I knew we never finished it and I wanted to finish it. So it's written by a man named Mitch Albom, and Mitch Albom is a sports writer. He works in Detroit. He used to be on a lot of shows on ESPN. He was a talking head, squawking, arguing about sports with other sports writers, that kind of thing. So he graduated from Brandeis University, I think it's called, and he had a professor named Maury Schwartz, who became his friend and his mentor. Okay, and I'm going to read you a little bit out of this book, so I hope you don't mind, but that's what I feel like I'm supposed to do. So the first thing here is Mitch describing, I'd say, meeting Maury. He says, "It is our first class together." I think he was a sociology professor, is what he was. He said, "It is our first class together in the spring of 1976. I enter Maury's large office and notice the seemingly countless books that line the wall, shelf after shelf. Books on sociology, philosophy, religion, psychology. There is a large rug on the hardwood floor and a window that looks out on the campus walk. Only a dozen or so students are there, fumbling with notebooks and syllabi. Most of them wear jeans and earth shoes and plaid flannel shirts. I tell myself it will not be easy to cut this class so small. Maybe I shouldn't take it. Mitchell," Maury says, reading from the attendance list, "I raise a hand. Do you prefer Mitch, or is Mitchell better? I have never been asked this by a teacher. I do a double take at this guy in his yellow turtleneck and green corduroy pants, the silver hair that falls to his forehead. He is smiling. Mitch, I say, Mitch is what my friends call me. Well, Mitch it is then," Maury says, as if closing a deal. "And Mitch, yes, I hope that one day you will think of me as a friend." So that's when he met his professor, okay? And they started to become friends. He started to become a mentor to him. He ended up working with him when he was trying to write his, whatever they call the things you write in college to help you graduate, huh? Yeah, yeah. He helped him with some of that kind of stuff, and he worked with him. And they would meet on Tuesdays a lot because the guy had office hours on Tuesday, I guess, for the students. Well, when Mitch graduated, he introduced his parents to Maury, and Maury told his parents, "You have a special boy here." And Mitch gave Maury a briefcase. When he graduated, he gave his professor a briefcase that had his initials on it. Maury's initials were on it. And it said he admired the briefcase, and he said, "Mitch, you are one of the good ones." And they hugged. And he asked Mitch if he will stay in touch. And Mitch says, "Of course," because he has become a friend and a mentor to him. So sorry. So Maury went on teaching and making friends out of students and mentoring students, swimming at the YMCA, which he loved to do, dancing, which Mitch said was, he danced like no one else was around, which I guess if you're going to dance, that's the way you should do it. He said he would go every Wednesday night to a church in Harvard Square and dance until he just dripped with sweat. And he was a happily married man. He had two sons of his own. So after college, Mitch became a sports writer. His dream was to be a piano player, but he wasn't good enough to be a piano player, I guess. So he became a sports writer. And he had saw an uncle of his who died at kind of a young age, and it kind of put something in him to really be driven to succeed. And he became a very successful sports writer. He wrote books, and like I said, he was on TV quite a bit. when I was younger, and I used to watch that stuff a lot. But despite his best intentions, Mitch did not stay in touch with Maury. He went 16 years without seeing him. And then one night, he got a very unexpected update on his old professor. You see, Maury had stopped dancing and had developed asthma in his 60s, and he started having trouble walking. He was weary all the time, he had trouble sleeping, and he dreamt he was dying. Maury and his wife Charlotte were told on a hot August day in 1994 that Maury had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. 16 years removed from his life, Mitch had no clue. Like I said, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to read you some stuff, but I feel like I'm supposed to. So, let's see which page is it. It says, in March of 1995, a limousine carrying Ted Koppel, the host of ABC TV's Nightline, pulled up to the snow-covered curb outside Maury's house in West Newton, Massachusetts. Maury was in a wheelchair full-time now, getting used to helpers lifting him like a heavy sack from the chair to the bed and the bed to the chair. He had begun to cough while eating, and chewing was a chore. His legs were dead. He would never walk again. Yet he refused to be depressed. Instead, Maury became a lightning rod of ideas. He jotted down his thoughts on yellow pads, envelopes, folders, scrap paper. He wrote bite-sized philosophies about living with death's shadow. Accept what you are able to do and what you are not able to do. Accept the past as past without denying it or discarding it. Learn to forgive yourself and to forgive others. Don't assume that it's too late to get involved. After a while, he had more than 50 of these aphorisms, which he shared with his friends. One friend, a fellow Brandeis professor named Maury Stein, was so taken with the words that he sent them to a Boston Globe reporter who came out and wrote a long feature story on Maury. The headline read, "A Professor's Final Course, His Own Death." The article caught the eye of a producer from the Nightline show who brought it to Koppel in Washington, D.C. "Take a look at this," the producer said. Next thing you knew, there were cameramen in Maury's living room and Koppel's limousine was in front of the house. Several of Maury's friends and family members had gathered to meet Koppel, and when the famous man entered the house, they buzzed with excitement, all except Maury, who wheeled himself forward, raised his eyebrows, and interrupted the clamor with his high sing-song voice. "Ted, I need to check you out before I agree to do this interview." There was an awkward moment of silence. Then the two men were ushered into the study. The door was shut. "Man," one friend whispered outside the door, "I hope Ted goes easy on Maury." "I hope Maury goes easy on Ted," said the other. Inside the office, Maury motioned for Koppel to sit down. He crossed his hands in his lap and smiled. "Tell me something close to your heart." Maury began. "My heart?" Koppel studied the man, the old man. "All right," he said cautiously, and he spoke about his children. They were close to his heart, weren't they? "Good," Maury said. "Now tell me something about your faith." Koppel was uncomfortable. "I usually don't talk about such things with people I've only known for a few minutes." "Ted, I'm dying," Maury said, peering over his glasses. "I don't have a lot of time here." Koppel laughed. "All right, faith." He quoted a passage from Marcus Aurelius, something he felt strongly about. Maury nodded. Now let me ask you something, Koppel said. Have you ever seen my program? Maury shrugged. Twice, I think. Twice, that's all? Don't feel bad. I've only seen Oprah once. He said, well, the two times you saw my show, what did you think? Maury paused. To be honest? Yes. I thought you were a narcissist. Koppel burst into laughter. I'm too ugly to be a narcissist, he said. So soon the cameras were rolling in front of the living room fireplace with Koppel in his crisp blue suit and Maury in his shaggy gray sweater. He had refused fancy clothes or makeup for this interview. His philosophy was that death should not be embarrassing. He was not about to powder his nose. No, I'm sorry, its nose. He wasn't going to powder death's nose. Because Maury sat in the wheelchair, the camera never caught his withered legs, and because he was still able to move his hands, Maury always spoke with both hands waving. He showed great passion when explaining how you face the end of life. Ted, he said, when all this started, I asked myself, am I going to withdraw from the world like most people do, or am I going to live? I decided I'm going to live, or at least try to live the way I want, with dignity, with courage, with humor, with composure. There are some mornings when I cry and cry and mourn for myself. Some mornings. I'm so angry and bitter, but it doesn't last too long. Then I get up and say, I want to live. So far, I've been able to do that. Will I be able to continue? I don't know. But I'm betting on myself that I will. Koppel seemed extremely taken with Maury. He asked about the humility that death induced. Well, Fred, Maury said accidentally, and then he quickly corrected himself. I mean, Ted. Now that's inducing humility, Koppel said, laughing. The two men spoke about the afterlife. They spoke about Maury's increasing dependency on other people. He already needed help eating and sitting and moving from place to place. What, Koppel asked, did Maury dread the most about his slow, insidious decay? Maury paused. He asked if he could say this certain thing on television. Koppel said, go ahead. Maury looked straight into the eyes of the most famous interview in America. Well, Ted, one day soon, someone's going to have to wipe my butt. I say butt. He didn't say butt. The program aired on a Friday night. It began with Ted Koppel from behind the desk in Washington, his voice booming with authority. Who is Maury Schwartz? He said. And why, why by the end of the night are so many of you going to care about him? 1,000 miles away in my house on the hill, I was casually flipping channels. I heard these words from the TV set. Who is Maury Schwartz? And went numb. So after this stunning update, Mitch went to see Maury. And he went to see him. And when he got there, Mitch hugged him. And he could hear his labored breathing. And Maury said, my old friend, you've come back at last. So as he was talking to him, this is what he said. He said, Mitch, he said softly, you know that I'm dying. I knew. All right then. Maury swallowed the pills, put down the paper cup, inhaled deeply, then let it out. Shall I tell you what it's like? What it's like to die? Yes, he said. Although I was unaware of it, our last class had just begun. Maury told Mitch, he said, Mitch, now that I'm dying, I've become much more interesting to people. People see me as a bridge. I'm not as alive as I used to be, but I'm not yet dead. I'm sort of in between. Dying, Maury suddenly said, is the only thing to be sad over, Mitch. Living unhappily is something else. So many of the people who come to visit me are unhappy. Why? Well, for one thing, the culture we have does not make people feel good about themselves. We're teaching the wrong things. And you have to be strong enough to say, if the culture doesn't work, don't buy it. Create your own. Most people can't do it. They're more unhappy than me, even in my current condition. I may be dying, but I am surrounded by loving, caring souls. How many people can say that? After Maury told Mitch that he would die by suffocation because of his asthma and the ALS, he kind of showed him that his doctor told him to take a deep breath and blow it out and start counting. And he had Mitch do it, and Mitch counted like 70-something. And he did it, and it was like 20-something, 30-something, and it had been more than that shortly before that, and he said, that will keep going down for me. So he kind of had an idea of himself, kind of how close he was getting to his lungs not wanting to work anymore. So after he told him about that and that he was going to suffocate, basically, Mitch was ready to go. And I'm sure he had a lot to process when he left. He hugged Maury and he said, come back and see your old professor. And a lot more earnest promise was made that day. I will, he said. So Mitch had to fly to England to cover Wimbledon tennis tournament. And while he was there, Maury's words came back to him as he walked around England. And this is what he thought. So many people walk around with a meaningless life. They seem half asleep. Even when they're busy doing things they think are important, this is because they're chasing the wrong things. The way you get meaning into your life is to devote yourself to loving others, devote yourself to your community around you, and devote yourself to creating something that gives you purpose and meaning. So when Mitch got back home from England, you know, God always does all things well. We don't always see it at the time, but he does. When he got back from England, there was a strike at his newspaper, a bitter strike. And he was going to be out of work for a while. Which early on, I think he tried to fill his time with writing and doing kind of the things that he normally does. And then he decided to call Maury. And when he answered the phone, he said, you're coming to visit me? That was the first thing he said. He says, well, could I? How about Tuesday, Maury said. Tuesday would be good. Now, on the first Tuesday that they got together, they talked about the world. Because Mitch noticed a stack of red newspapers in his den there. And he asked him, he said, you bother keeping up with the news? Yes, Maury said, is that strange? Do you think because I'm dying, I shouldn't care what happens in the world? Maybe, Mitch said. Maybe you're right, said Maury. I won't see how it all turns out. He said, now that I'm suffering, I feel closer to people who suffer than ever before. You know, I remember years and years ago, I was supposed to speak at the mission, and the message that God gave me was that there was a common bond that all men share, and that's of loss and defeat. We have all lost, and we have all been defeated. And if nothing else can help you bond with someone, that can. A room full of men who are living on the street and drug addicts and alcoholics, and a 20-year-old guy who's got a loving wife and a job and kids and a family that loves him, what are we going to bond over? You know? And that was what God kind of brought to me to bring to the men. One thing Maury said that the disease had taught him was that the most important thing in life is to learn how to give out love and to let it come in. Let it come in. He said, we think we don't deserve love. We think if we let it in, we'll become too soft. Then he quoted a writer named Levine, who said, love is the only rational act. Now, I don't know who Levine is, so I'm not promoting Levine and or his ideas about anything. I just know this quote he made right here, I agree with. Love is to be our action always. Anything else falls short of our purpose. And when I wrote that down, I immediately thought of something that I have probably read 15 times in the 15 weddings that I've done over the years. 1 Corinthians 13. Paul describes love like this. Love is very patient and kind, never jealous or envious, never boastful or proud, never haughty or selfish or rude. Love does not demand its own way. It is not irritable or touchy. It does not hold grudges and will hardly even notice when others do it wrong. It is never glad about injustice, but rejoices whenever truth wins out. If you love someone, you will be loyal to him no matter what the cost. You will always believe in him, always expect the best of him, and always stand your ground in defending him. Now, if Mitch could have predicted Maury's health problems, he surely would have kept in touch after graduation and been a better friend for those 16 years. And you know, Maury could have been angry and bitter to Mitch when he came back into his life, but he chose to love him. The only rational act he spoke of. He didn't ask, where have you been? Why didn't you stay in touch? Where were you when I needed you? Instead, in love, he asked these questions when he first got there. Have you found someone to share your heart with? Are you giving to your community? Are you at peace with yourself? Are you trying to be as human as you can be? Can you tell why this book has touched a lot of people? So, to close, I want to review for just a second. We can't predict the future. When you reach the threshold of what you know, continue forward in faith. Don't exhaust yourself trying to be something. Just be what you are, and God will do the rest. And our call to action each day is to love. God's creation. I'll close in a word of prayer. Lord, I thank you for speaking to me and answering my prayer that you would talk to me and let me know what to say today. And I thank you for that. And I thank you for these two men that I've never met, but their relationship has helped a lot of people as they've read this book, and it's made them think about their own life. And I thank you for all the positive changes that have come from people who've read this book and I just pray that it gives you glory, Lord. And I just thank you for everyone here today, Lord. And just keep your hand of mercy and protection on all of them. And we love you. Amen.